What kind of people does the Lord use to do His work in the great conflict between good and evil? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, as we continue our series on rebellion and redemption. My conversation partners are again Brant Berglund from the Walla Walla University School of Theology and Jennifer Ogden, Associate Pastor of the Walla Walla University Church. Let me start with my leading question. Can you give me a succinct answer? What kind of people does God use in the great struggle between good and evil?
He uses people like you and me. People who are fallible, people who have great strengths and great weaknesses, all mixed into one bundle.
I think he'll use anybody, and I mean anybody, even those who maybe are not attuned to his will, but he can sure use a lot more easily somebody who is listening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have King Saul showing up here, but I think that's a classic example where the Lord kind of grabs Saul by the back of the neck and say, you're going to be my person anyway, and turns Saul into a glossolalia example, and it was amazing. But in any event, let's look at the well-known numbers. And what I've done here is I looked at these people and went through them, trying to find some common ground. I made a list of characteristics, the things that I think God would like to have in his people. Integrity, fearlessness, gentleness, consistency, courage, tenacity. Those are things that I think I would like to see in role models. Now, the very first one we come to is David. And interestingly enough, they use his conviction at the time of Goliath. You know, the Lord gives victory, you know, ta-da, and he goes out there and wipes out this Philistine. Now, if you stop and think about the story a bit, it is horrifying. Here's David carrying the head of Goliath into town.
That he hewed off with Goliath's own sword.
That's right. See? And he kills him twice, according to the record. He kills him once with a sword and once with a stone. So he really got Goliath good.
Yeah. See?
But we often, with kids, they don't realize the violence. And I don't know whether that's good or bad. I remember once in Scotland, we were having a Sabbath afternoon Bible quiz for the kids, and we were working through the Samuel Kings. And I still remember the vivid question, and what happened to all the sons of, I think it was Abijah or something like that, one of the kings up there. And one little kid, maybe about 8 or 9, just with his small voice, he says, they cut off their heads and made a big pile of them right outside the city gates. You know, and, you know, it was so ghastly to hear this little kid saying that so cheerfully. But so you take David, who stands firm for what he believed to be right, but then the other counterfoil, and this is mentioned in our study guide, is his experience with Bathsheba, where he was a basket case.
The narrative says the time of the season, the springtime when kings go out to war, but David stayed at home. And as if the narrator is painting a story that David should have been doing something else from the start and put himself in a place where temptation was ripe.
Yeah.
And he's the same man who fought Goliath but can't fight the lusts of his own flesh.
Yeah. And I've heard some fairly perverse sermons, at least I call them perverse. You know, David was a man after God's own heart. And then they list all the nasty things that David did as if that came from having a heart right with God. No, there was a certain honesty about David. You could say that he was an honest sinner. But I think God would much rather have someone who doesn't sin at all rather than say, I did it and I was very evil. So, I mean, you look at the way David had the chance many times to kill Saul and did not. That has to be amazing notch on his hatchet hand as far as God is concerned, that he did not take vengeance against his enemy. And I think that was really good.
Self-control so. In spite of his desire perhaps for violence.
Yep. Now, another one, Elijah. How would you like to have Elijah as a roommate or as a husband, Jennifer?
I think I'm good. I think I'm okay.
You're okay.
Huh? Yeah.
You'd be okay without him,
I'd be okay
huh?
without, yeah. I think it might be a little tempestuous.
He was very direct man, and yet fell, you know, right after a huge victory, and perhaps that says something about our own sensitivity to or our own proclivity to failure soon after a great victory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there again, we have this man up there who goes down and beheads all the prophets of Baal. I mean, here's a violent man. He curls up outside the palace gates, and Jezebel sends a message to him and says, guess what? You'll be like one of those by this time tomorrow. And the guy is scared to death. I mean, he heads out a long ways. He's going all the way to Mount Sinai, which is a long ways.
Yeah.
He hightails it.
But there's a wonderful story in there how he gets so exhausted, says, you know, I'm no better than them. You know, take away my life. And he goes to sleep. And an angelic messenger comes, wakes him up, and gives him something to eat and drink. And he goes back again.
A couple times, right?
Yeah, a couple of times. And then he goes to Mount Sinai, where he wanted to see some thunder and light. Now, that's where Sinai was famous for. But he gets there instead. God shows up in a still, small voice. He says, what are you doing here, Elijah? Well, so on. So it's an amazing story. His understudy is not one of the ones that we're to have here, is Elisha. It's really quite a contrast. The only violent miracle that we have, well, there are two from Elisha. One was the two she-bears that mauled the 42 boys. And then Naaman, he transferred the leprosy of Naaman to
Gehazi.
Yeah. But other than that, all the miracles from Elisha, in contrast to Elijah, where almost all his miracles were violent ones, Elisha, all those were nice and helpful ones. And so I'm wondering that after he had that example and he cursed the boys, he got to thinking to himself, you know, maybe that was a bit much. And try a different perspective. So Elijah, before, during, and after Mount Carmel, he's an amazing person. And the Lord used him, violent man for a violent age, perhaps we could say. Then we come to Esther. Now, we need a feminine comment on this, Jen.
In the era that we live in, where human trafficking and such is so prevalent, it's interesting that Esther kind of started in that same realm and yet went on to such a strong display of what can happen when you choose to have faith in God and when you choose to really adhere to his invectives and really choose to pursue his life in your own life. So I think that she was a really valiant, brave, courageous woman. And I think that we need more Esthers, men and women, who are willing to be brave and courageous and to stand against corruption in such visible ways.
And in spite of the things that had been done to her, she didn't have much choice but to go before the king. It's not like she could have chose him out of a loving heart and he for her. The narrative doesn't paint that story that way.
In that era, at all. When the king's representative comes and says, you will come with me, you know, you don't have much choice. And so that's an unhappy part of the story. And the interesting thing, I like to present this, and if we're looking at God uses all kinds of people, it's often, I find a contrast between Daniel and Esther, because Daniel never pulled any punches at all. He went and prayed three times a day, and his friends stood on the plain of Dura within the Adventist community. That form of stand up has always been emphasized. Almost never do we recognize the fact that Esther did not identify herself at all until the very last minute.
Perhaps that says something about our need to be sensitive to time and place, to situations, and to God's leading. I know there's even a verse in the Old Testament that says a wise man will stay silent in such times because they are evil. Mm-hmm. There's times to stay silent. Mm-hmm. There's times to stand up.
Mm-hmm. I think it also speaks to a male and female nature. Men are usually a little more head-on, confrontery, violent, whereas women are like, okay, how can we work this out behind the scenes? What do I need to do in order to help this reveal itself? Mm-hmm. And I think that she very wisely, very astutely worked the political angle and was able to allow God's message and revelation to be fully revealed in that situation.
If I can use maybe a not so savory analogy, but she played the hand well that was dealt to her, and she took what was there to redeem her people ultimately. So God did use her. And we didn't talk about Mordecai, but God used him as well as I think one of the heroes of the story.
And started out, he just refused to bow to Haman. And that's amazing to be able to be brave enough to do that, you know, risk your neck.
head on, Jen. Yeah, you mentioned here's a man who's being outwardly antagonistic.
Yeah,
very much so.
And I don't know whether the modern parallel works here, but you know, people who talk a lot, like me, often get filtered out. You know, we expect Thompson to talk, you know, and so we just won't pay that much attention to him. But I remember when I was a student, one of the stalwart women on our campus, in fact, she's still in our community, but when she would sit on a on a committee, she didn't say very much. But towards the end, she'd say, well, now, it seems to me that, and everybody just rolled over and played dead, you know. She saved her words until it really counted, and I suspect there may be some of that as far as Esther is concerned.
Mm.
Now, one last person on our list here is Hezekiah. Against the Assyrians, but in dialogue with the Babylonians. So again, you have somebody who was very strong and somebody who was very weak. Sennacherib came up, and Hezekiah stood firm, wouldn't bend. But what happened when the Babylonians came?
A little different approach. He lets them in.
Shows them all his wealth. And what did the Lord have to say about those two approaches?
There's less, how might I say it, less evaluation by the narrator of Hezekiah's final experience with the Babylonians than I would like. I'd love to hear more of how God felt specifically about it. But because the Babylonians had come in and seen all these things, God could say, they will now be taken from you. But it won't be in your time. It'll be in the time of your children. Oh, so my kids are going to be involved in this controversy through some of my actions too, perhaps.
Now, there's an interesting narrative. We don't have time to go into that here. You compare the story in Chronicles and you compare the story here in Kings, because when the prophet tells him, at least it won't, you know, it's not going to be in your day, and Hezekiah responds, according to the biblical author, yes, but at least it won't happen in my day. That is a pretty nasty dig at the king, to say it that way. So, the kings, and we could go through the story of the kings. You have good king, bad king, good king, bad king. The kids always seem to turn out opposite. I mean, you have some of the best kings came from the worst parents. And I think we need to keep that in mind.
Hmm.
This now completes basically our survey of the Old Testament. Next week, we turn to the New Testament and Jesus' temptations, and we'll have to pay some close attention to that. My conversation partners are Brant and Jen. I want to thank both of you again, and my thanks to David Olson, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. With a good word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.